You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many sports tend to favor younger athletes over those growing older, and when we think about dancers, we might see the same thing. We'll hear about a Wisconsin dance show that shines a spotlight on the talents and experience of seven female dancers, all aged 50 and above. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is making an unsettling prediction. Unless something dramatic changes, the number of cases of Alzheimer's disease in the U.S. will nearly triple in the next 40 years. The disease is the fifth most common cause of death among people 65 and older, and as of now, there are no effective treatments. A Milwaukee researcher is working to change that. Karen Frick is a psychology professor at UW-Milwaukee. She's leading a team that's working to find a treatment for Alzheimer's. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much.
So here's the CDC saying this huge increase in the number of people with Alzheimer's by the year 2060. What's your reaction to their prediction?
I think it's dead on. It really is in line with numbers that the Alzheimer's Association has been generating for several years.
Is this a question of more a higher rate of people are going to be developing Alzheimer's, or is this just sheer demographics? We're going to have more older people, and they're the most likely people to have Alzheimer's.
I think it's in some respects it's a combination of both, but I think it's more that that there are more older people. Age is the primary risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So the grayer our population, the more people are simply more likely to develop the disease. Although I think also our diagnosis, ability to diagnose the disease are far greater than they used to be. So more people are being diagnosed more accurately these days.
Now, age, as you mentioned, was a primary factor in risk for Alzheimer's. Are there any other demographic indicators, groups of people who are more or less likely that we know of now to get Alzheimer's?
Absolutely. Women. Women are, they're about two-thirds of the Alzheimer's population right now. So women are considerably greater risk. We also tend to see greater incidence of Alzheimer's disease in minority populations, so Hispanics and African Americans. It's unclear why that is, whether there's something about that has something to do with race or socioeconomic status, education. So that's something we don't know yet enough about. But there are certainly genetic causes. So Alzheimer's disease isn't a single disease per se. There are people who get Alzheimer's disease very early on in their 50s and 60s. We call that early onset Alzheimer's, and those that seems to be associated with certain genetic mutations, and that can run in families. The later onset Alzheimer's disease that hits people in sort of the 60s and beyond, 70s and 80s. There is a genetic risk factor for that late onset Alzheimer's disease associated with a specific protein, and there again, if you have a certain variant of that protein, you're more likely to get the disease, especially if you're female.
Now, there are a lot of pieces to the Alzheimer's puzzle related to prevention, detection, treatment, and I want to get into some of that big picture stuff. But first of all, you and your team, which piece of the puzzle are you working on, and what are you looking at in particular?
Right, so we're working on sort of the female piece of the puzzle, trying to understand why women are at greater risk for the disease. We think that it has to do, at least in part, to menopause. Because the hormones that are produced by ovaries in women, it turns out that they're very important chemicals to keeping brain cells healthy. And so when women go through menopause, their ovaries age, and they stop producing those hormones, we think that that makes neurons in those parts of the brain that deteriorate in Alzheimer's disease, and they're important for cognitive function, more vulnerable to the brain pathology of Alzheimer's disease. So what we're trying to do in our lab is to better understand on a molecular and cellular level exactly how those hormones are affecting memory formation so that some of those molecules could potentially be targets for future drug development that might provide some of the benefits of estrogens without some of the side effects of current hormone therapies.
Now, I want to get this out there for women going through menopause right now. maybe this is, it isn't guaranteed that going through menopause is going to cause Alzheimer's.
No, not at all. Not at all. It just said of the Alzheimer's patients out there, about two-thirds of them are women. So it's a risk factor. There's no certainty.
And in the wider world of treatment, we really don't have much, do we, for people who have diagnosed Alzheimer's?
Unfortunately not. That's the really tragic thing about this this rise in Alzheimer's cases is that the medications that most people are on for the disease, you know, are 20 years old or so, and they can manage some of the symptoms for relatively short periods of time, but there is no treatment, really effective treatment we have for reducing some of the cognitive symptoms or, more importantly, for stopping the disease. The important point the Alzheimer's Association makes is that there's never, ever been a survivor of Alzheimer's disease, and we want to change that.
Well, and that speaks to what you mentioned earlier about the different factors involved in it. There's a genetic element, this hormonal element. I think there's still a possibility, right, that there are environmental causes, too?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, so we still, despite everything that researchers have learned about this disease, we still don't really know what causes it. And so there was the field has focused for the last, probably 20 years on the pathological. So there's a buildup of certain proteins in an Alzheimer's brain that you see to some extent in normal aging, but to a much greater extent in Alzheimer's disease. And the field is really focused on those proteins and trying to get rid of them, as thinking that they're the major causative agents for the disease. And while there may be that might possibly be true, some of the most recent clinical trials trying to decrease levels of this amyloid protein that's in the brain haven't worked out all that well, particularly in patients who already have the disease. So most efforts on those anti-amyloid treatments are focused in trying to figure out who might get the disease and see if those treatments can prevent the onset of the disease in those patients. But because those clinical trials haven't been over-the-moon successful, I think it's caused many people in the field to look at other potential causes like environmental causes, potentially hormones, other genetic risk factors. There's a sense that stress may play a role, that diet and exercise can play a role. So right now, I think people are very open to thinking outside of the box.
Talking to Karen Frick, psychology professor at UW-Milwaukee and researcher on a team looking at Alzheimer's, hopefully looking for treatments down the road. Karen, let's get into that detection side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we don't have a treatment, it's good if we can detect Alzheimer's earlier. That might in turn help us lead to some of the causes and treatments down the road. What is the state of detection of Alzheimer's as early as possible?
Right, so that's where a lot of researchers in the field are focusing their attention. There's been an increasing awareness that by the time a patient starts to show symptoms, starts to have memory loss and confusion, that there have been pathological changes going on in their brain for probably 10 to 20 years before that point. And so if most people develop the disease, say, in their mid-60s, probably somewhere in their mid-40s, some of these changes in the brain have already started happening. And so so the field has been trying to develop what we call biomarkers for those pathological changes. The Alzheimer's used to pretty much only be able to be definitively diagnosed at autopsy. You could, slice up someone's brain and look at these amyloid depositions. But now we have functional neuroimaging tests that will allow us to be able to see those plaques and another inclusion called neurofibrillary tangles in the brains of Alzheimer's patients. The unfortunate part is that they're very expensive, those tests. So right now they're mainly being used in clinical trials, so research studies. There are some biomarkers that are or some potential biomarkers in cerebrospinal fluid. So you would do a spinal tap and measure levels of certain proteins in the spinal fluid. But, of course, nobody likes having
spinal
tap. That's
not fun, no.
No. So really the holy grail is a blood test. And I think we're making strides towards a blood test, at least for these sort of hallmark pathological elements of the disease. So it might be within 5-10 years or so that we have a blood test for early, what would sort of early onset probable Alzheimer's disease.
And let's talk about prevention a little. And every now and then we'll see a headline from a source of varying reliability. X food helps prevent Alzheimer's, X supplement, doing crossword puzzles, whatever.
Right.
Are there factors that we say, yeah, there does seem to be a significant benefit to this in Alzheimer's prevention?
Yeah, we're getting there. I think the data do seem to suggest that particularly exercise can be beneficial, and not only for Alzheimer's disease, but for keeping your brain healthy throughout aging, even just normal aging. So maintaining regular amounts of exercise, which helps keep pumping oxygen to your brain, which is important because your brain needs oxygen, but it can't store it. So we need to get blood pumping to our brains in order to keep them healthy. Also, regular, you know, a good diet seems to be important in terms of keeping our brains healthy. So really, lifestyle choices that we make early on in our 30s, 40s, and 50s can, the data seem to suggest that they can help in terms of protecting our brains potentially from the detrimental effects of aging or, Alzheimer's or other neurodegenerative diseases.
So eat our veggies, do some exercise. I mean, there are a lot of benefits
pretty
there,
much.
Even if it isn't a magic bullet on Alzheimer's.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, even, so Alzheimer's is one of several kinds of dementias, including things like vascular dementias that are caused by, you know, buildup of artery clogging plaques in the brain and elsewhere in the body. So everything you would do for maintaining good heart health would decrease your risk of, say, vascular dementias. So, you know, the tried and true diet and exercise will surely help reap benefits as we get older.
Now, as a part of a research team on this, how hopeful are you that your research and all the other research going on out there is going to give us something that helps to significantly either prevent or treat Alzheimer's in, say, the next 10, 15 years?
Yeah, gosh. I mean, you know, doing basic research like we do, you know, you recognize that it could be many, many years from, you know, discoveries we make in the lab to ultimately something that's going to help patients. But we have to keep that hope. I mean, that really, you know, keeps us going to think the things that we're going to learn here in our laboratory will help inform, you know, the next generation of treatments, whether they directly lead to a potentially novel drug or potentially lead to an insight that can be incorporated into a clinical trial that, you know, can ultimately help people. So we always have to be optimistic and have that hope that that this work will ultimately lead to something that will benefit people's lives.
We'll leave it there for now. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Karen Frick is a psychology professor at UW-Milwaukee. We talked with her about her research in finding a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. Coming to Madison this weekend is a dance show featuring 7 performers who all share one thing in common, their age. The performance is called Dancing on the Ceiling, performances by women of a certain age. It'll showcase dancers aged 50 and above. Li Chao-Ping is the violist research professor at the UW-Madison Dance Department and artistic director of Li Chao-Ping Dance. Chao-Ping is co-presenting the show Dancing on the Ceiling with the UW-Madison Dance Department and will be a performer as well. Chao-Ping, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Also joining us is Simone Farrow, chair of the Department of Dance at UW-Milwaukee. She was part of the show's creation and will also be one of the 7 solo performers. Simone, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, Simone, I understand the idea from the show originally came from you. Can you talk a little bit about what the thinking was behind Dancing on the Ceiling?
So So this idea started in 2014, believe it or not, and I sat down with my colleague Sarah Hook, who is a professor at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the dance department, and we started talking about the value that we put in the young body, and as we mature as dancers and our performances start getting smaller in terms of frequencies, and how much we could still, and we feel as mature women, how much we feel that we still have a lot to contribute to the field with the performances with bodies that are not the conventional or not as young as we are accustomed to see on the stage. So from there, it spawned that I connected with several of my colleagues, and here we are. This is our third incarnation, let's say, of this set of performances, and the Champaign has been part of two of them. And we are very much looking forward to performing in Madison tomorrow and Saturday.
Champaign, we hear in the movie industry in Hollywood that there aren't always great roles for women over age 25, 30 sometimes. Is there something similar in the dance world where choreographers, dance company directors aren't thinking of women over 50, say, as who they want out front and center?
Absolutely. I think that there is a bit of an age bias in some ways. And it's not that it's, there's not a rule about it, but in general, we are looking for those, young, agile athletes who are, capable of virtuosic feats and, able to accomplish a lot of incredible athletic tasks, with their dancing. But what we will bring is something that will be more nuanced, richer, has more depth to our performances.
Yeah, Simone, can you talk about that a little, about how you think your dancing has changed over your years?
It's very interesting because just hearing Chopin's talk, when you are a mover, you are a dancer, you observe dance with your body as much as you observe dance with your intellect. And very often your body has reacts in a way that you would like the body to actually respond. And often it doesn't, because our image, our internal image, is still very vivid, that memory of being on the stage, being a virtuosic dancer, is still so embedded in our DNA that sometimes you go to the studio and you try something, and of course, the body is reacting in a very, very different way. So when we talk about this maturity, we also talk about a refinement of that technique. You talk about a perspective of what is essential for a dance to happen. Of course, the virtuosity, the athleticism is one part, but there is that wisdom that is provided by that mature body that is undeniable. And this is, I think, what we bring to this performance.
Champaign, when you're choreographing, I guess, coming up with a dance, do you think differently? Okay, well, we don't have that younger, more athletic body doing this, but that's okay. It isn't just athleticism and stunts in a way. We can really focus on something more artistic.
Sure. I know that myself as a dancer choreographing on my own body, that I have to work with what I have. I have, probably as Simone was saying, have visions of what I'd like to be doing. And I probably push that edge a lot. I'm one who loves, a lot of physicality and my movement. I also really appreciate risk-taking. I love dancers who challenge themselves. So the kinds of things that I hope for out of my dancers, I try to get out of myself.
And Simone, you're coming to Madison. You've done other shows. Can you talk about the response to the shows and the anticipation for them so far?
I think that there is a certain identification when women see other women doing something non-traditional. And in the previous shows that we did one in Iowa City and one here in Milwaukee, the responses were that these women felt represented on the stage. These women felt connected. There is an importance. Because I think that this, the body, as the body ages, the body becomes in our society almost insignificant, and I think that seeing a show where women are working with their bodies with their capabilities, like Chaoping was saying, pushing our boundaries, because you know, for me to be on the stage tomorrow, I had to leave my emails and leave all the administrative work that I have to do to be on a classroom with my students, taking class from one of my peers. So when we go there and we actually share those experiences, we are sharing the experiences of pain, of happiness, of transcendence, of what this body, you know, and the labels that are put in this body can bring.
And Chaoping, as we start to wrap up, I understand these shows over the next 2 days are officially sold out.
I hate to say that. I think that there might be some chances still for a few seats. They may be obstructed or some people may not show up. So please.
There's still a shot to see them.
There's still a shot. But I'm excited for the response to our show.
Well, and with that response, I wanted to ask you, does that mean there's a good chance of a sequel?
Ooh. Well, we'll have to talk more about that.
All right. Or maybe more performances.
Absolutely.
Of this show.
I think, you know, there's definitely the demand for it. So we hope that, you know, the show will continue on and tour to other cities. To echo what Simone said, I firmly believe in one being able to dance through life. And I think that we can enter into the dance at all stages throughout our lives.
It's a great place to leave it. Chaoping, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Simone, thanks for being with us.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having us.
We're talking to Lee Chaoping from UW-Madison and Simone Faro from UW-Milwaukee. They're both dancing in this show called Dancing on the Ceiling in Madison. Two performances, Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 2:30 p.m. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. The rain has finally, apparently, come to an end around Wisconsin. That's the good news. The bad news, we still have a bit of flooding to talk about. Many rivers around the state, especially in southern Wisconsin, are experiencing varying levels of flooding. The Wisconsin River in Portage is forecast to reach major flood stage later this week. According to the National Weather Service, Madison has received 10.25 inches of rain since September 1st, about 6 1/3 inches above average. That follows major flooding in August, in which areas just west of Madison got up to 15 inches of rain in one day. Besides all those water issues, if you haven't stuck your head outside today, it's a bit chilly. Todd Shea is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in La Crosse. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, can we expect, Todd, any kind of dry weather to let us catch up a little bit with all that rain over the last couple months?
Yeah, that's the good news. We finally kind of broke the spell, at least, you know, for the next week or so. Drier, but a cooler pattern. But I think we would take the drier right now after all we've been through since about mid-August, August 20th or so.
What areas around the state still have rivers and lakes at a flood stage at risk of flooding?
Well, most of the higher water is in the central and southern part of the state. That's where most of the rain has fallen over the last, you know, 30 to 40 days. So there is a lot of minor flooding, along and north of Interstate 94, kind of in the central part of the state. But when you get down south of Interstate 94, south of Madison, south of the Madison-Milwaukee corridor, and into the southwest part of the state, there is still some moderate flooding going on, and as mentioned, the Wisconsin River is still coming up in some areas. So we still have several days of above, normal and above flood stage water to deal with in the southern half of the state.
That sure feels like we've gotten a lot of rain. Have we hit records, or have we been way above average for this time of year, or does it just feel that way?
No, I know there's been a lot of records set, and we've certainly been above average some places, you know, receiving in a couple of days what you normally would in a month's time. I kind of went through and looked since August 20th, which was the first heavy rain event that hit the Madison, Middleton, Cross Plains, Mount Horeb area. And then we've had several heavy rain events, if you will, across the state since then. Most of the heaviest rain on the order of 20 inches or more since August 20th, and, you know, that's almost two-thirds of what normally would fall in a year's time has hit. And the wettest corridor has been, again, the southern half of the state, kind of from a La Crosse over towards Adams Friendship, Wautoma, and areas south. You know, some areas in, for example, in central Wisconsin, the Mauston area, almost 28 inches of rain since August 20th. The Madison area, you know, 15 to 18 inches. West Bend, almost 20 inches. So there's been a hefty amount of rain that's fallen.
Do you hit a point then where the water's so high everywhere and the ground's so saturated that even if you just have normal rainfall from here on out, we're still at risk because there's just nowhere for the water to go?
Yeah, that's true. And with this last round of rain here over the past, a week or so, you know, we kind of were worried about that going into that weather pattern, that everything is just so saturated. You know, people are out mowing their lawns or trying to, or just anytime you walk on a grass area, it's just squishy. And so even the lightest of rainfall, I've noticed, starts to pond in areas. And then if you have any kind of high rainfall rates, that's the cases where we're seeing the rivers rise quicker than they normally would, flash flooding occurring normally or quicker than it normally would. So, like I said, luckily we're in a little bit of a drier stretch here, and at least we can try to get the river levels down a bit.
Talking to Todd Shea, warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in La Crosse. By the way, we want to hear from you. We're going to take your calls in a few minutes. How did this flooding season, this high rainfall, affect you, your community, your farm, your house, you name it? Let us know. You can call in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Todd, I don't know how long it takes to catch up with these high water levels. Is there a concern that, okay, if we end up in the winter with a heavy snowfall season, we're already, our levels are so high, that could be a problem?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say if this wet pattern will progress through the winter and necessarily reflect a snowier than normal winter. But I think one concern we all have is going into the next spring snowmelt season. You know, one of the factors that always goes into that is where the river's at, what's the saturation level of the soils. And, you know, we know that we're going to go into the spring snowmelt already with those factors working against us. So, you know, we'll obviously have to see how the winter pans out and how the melt occurs next spring. But, yeah, you know, when you go into a winter with high water already, it certainly is not a good thing.
Now, looking back again at this heavy rainfall season, what's going on up in the atmosphere there that's led to all of this rainy weather?
You know, I would think the main factor has been the kind of stuck weather patterns that we've been in. You know, before August 20th and before the end of August heavy rain events hit, we did have a couple of weeks of pretty dry weather going, and then the weather pattern took a shift. Now, I don't know if any of us meteorologists out there know exactly why a weather pattern sets up and persists as long as it seems to at times. But we went into a warmer and a wetter weather pattern that just kept allowing, you know, the higher humidity levels, the higher moisture values, and that adds to the fuel for these storms. And then when they start to reform over the same areas, like we saw in the Madison and Middleton area in around August 20th, that's when you can get those high rain events, the flash flooding, a big impact. And then sometimes you have patterns where it sets up for days like that, and that was kind of the end of August into September that we experienced. And so, you know, just kind of a weather pattern that refused to shift for a while. Luckily, like we've talked about, it's shifted now to a colder, drier pattern.
Now, we've got some flooding in the news today. Apparently, Duluth, and I'm not sure if it hit Superior too, but flooded because of high winds on Lake Superior. Is that a story you're watching?
Yeah, a little bit. A National Weather Service up in the Duluth area is certainly on top of that. But, you know, there is one other area of the state that did have, you know, some above normal rainfalls too, and that is southeast of the Ashland area and southeast of Superior. And now with this kind of cold spell, this kind of fall system that just went through had brought in a lot of wind with it, and that is a big impact on the Great Lakes. And so that's a slightly different type of weather phenomena as this weather pattern kind of shifted. But nonetheless, they've had their shares of impact in the northern and the Northland as well.
And Todd, as we start to wrap up, you mentioned we've got what looks like a dry spell in the short run coming up. What are the longer term forecasts for the remaining couple months of the fall?
Well, luckily, you know, it was looking like going in October that it was going to be, above normal precipitation chances, kind of a near normal temperature scheme. Not a lot of signals either way as we go into the, first couple months of winter outside of maybe going back to a more of a near normal temperature and precipitation pattern. So, you know, hopefully just the, as you mentioned earlier, the near normal rain or snowfalls don't cause us any more headaches with that.
Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you, and stay safe out there.
Todd Shea is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in La Crosse. We talked to them about flooding concerns around Wisconsin after all the rain we've gotten over the last couple of months. Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your own experiences with this weather. Did you have flooding issues near you, on your property, on your farm, in your neighborhood this summer and fall, maybe even in the last week? Any damage to your home or property? What is recovery going like for you? And yeah, if you're a farmer, how has all of this water affected you? Harvest time right now, we're hearing stories about apart from flooding damage, also that heavy farm equipment, it's too muddy to get it out into some fields. If that's something you're experiencing, we'd love to hear your story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Lots of ways to share your story coming up on Central Time. We continue our discussion about recent and current flooding issues around the state. We just heard from a meteorologist about what's been going on and fortunately a more dry spell ahead. Now you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you personally run into flooding problems at home, at work, on the road? How was your life affected? What are things like in your community? We've heard places like Gay's Mills, a lot of flooding there in the past, also this year. Talk about what is the future of that town. Is that something going on in your community? And how did neighbors help out? Were you out sandbagging? If you're a farmer, what has all the heavy rain meant for your crops and the fall harvest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go to Aaron on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and great program. Say, I have an idea maybe to prevent future floods.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, so imagine you dig big holes where flooding typically occurs, and you deposit in those holes sort of like water towers, underground water towers, with a valve that when it floods, it opens up and takes away that water and maybe holds it in reservoir to be used for farms or for when it's a drought.
Interesting. I'm not a civic engineer, but it's an interesting idea, Aaron. And I know we were talking to a guest yesterday saying we need to do a lot of different things in communities around Wisconsin, permeable surfaces, rain gardens, better water management in a lot of ways. Thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Steve in Fort Atkinson. Steve, hello.
Hello.
What's your story, Steve? How did you experience this flooding season?
It's ongoing. I mean, I live on the Rock River in Fort Atkinson, but I don't live in Fort Atkinson. I live in the township of Koshkonong, so I live right outside of Fort Atkinson on the river road that connects to 106, State Highway 106. Well, I get everybody's firewood, trash that they make. You know, it might have tipped over when the water got too high, so I got baby diapers and trash.
Oh, just washing up from the flood?
Oh, sure, sure. So I got the Bark River flooding my backyard, and then the front yard, the Rock River floods, and it comes over the road into my front yard. So I have my house is set up a little higher, so it doesn't affect me as much as it does the neighbors. But yeah, I get all that stuff in the yard, and every time it goes down, then I got to pick it up, and, you know, it's just a mess.
All right. How does it look in the yard today?
I got my dog kennel. I poured some concrete and put a kennel in for my German Shepherd, and I got it set back into the yard. It's not real close to the house, and I took her out this morning before I went to work, and it was really dark, but it's getting up to the kennel again.
Uh-oh.
And like I said, that'd be the Bark River coming into my backyard. And she don't go to her normal spot that she, you know, takes care of her business. She's, because it's flooded.
Oh, no.
So it kind of confuses her, and she don't know where to go, you know.
Well, Steve, thanks for calling in, and good luck to you and your German Shepherd. And I hope you watch that water recede away from your yard from both of those rivers. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Jeff with us in Burlington. Jeff, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I called in because I'm a town supervisor in the town of Burlington, and one of the responsibilities of town governments is stormwater management, and there is quite a tension between people who want to build a nice new home on a nice vacant lot that's been there forever, and the fact that we have to be very careful about how much more impermeable surface we introduce. Because the more of that, the more flooding you get.
So are you having to make those tough decisions to say, no, you can't develop or you can't develop in this way because we're at a saturation point, if you will?
We haven't gotten to the point where we've absolutely said no, but we have gotten to the point where we've said you're going to have to do some extra construction of either a stormwater retention system or a rain garden or something to make sure that every drop of water that lands on your property never leaves it.
And Jeff, with all the flooding around the state this year, is this kind of lighting a fire under people like you and people in your community to tackle this problem now before the next flooding season?
You know, I think anybody who is forward-looking has to accept the fact that as we grow and build, everything has to go somewhere, and if we don't allow water to get back into the aquifers, we're going to have problems on many different levels, not just flooding.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234 to share your flooding story. We heard from Clarence in Jefferson County. Clarence called in to say that he lost about 100 acres of his corn and soybean crop, says he'll barely break even this year. It's a story we've heard from a lot of farmers. I've been seeing in the news concerns about the harvest and lost crops from the flood. We'll be talking more about that tomorrow, by the way, after 4 o'clock in our weekly roundup of some of the top stories around Wisconsin. Thanks to our callers who shared their stories. You can keep sharing your stories at 800-642-1234. Also, you can get online and let us know what's going on with you. We've got a conversation open on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Republicans have been campaigning against the law known as Obamacare for nearly a decade. Now, with President Trump in the White House and a new lawsuit winding its way through the courts, there's a real chance that the Affordable Care Act could be repealed. In our ongoing series about how health care is playing out in this year's election campaigns, WPR reporter Shemaine Mills has this story on what Republicans say should replace the Affordable Care Act.
Arlen Kettlebaiter of Cross Plains knows the Affordable Care Act better than most. Kettlebaiter retired just 6 months shy of his 65th birthday, the age when he would qualify for Medicare. He bought insurance on the Affordable Care Act marketplace, but it was expensive.
We had even thought about skipping insurance for 6 months. I've always been in pretty good health and all that kind of stuff. 2 months after I retired, I had cancer.
Kettlebaiter had lymphoma, and the doctors treated it aggressively. He underwent chemotherapy, went into cardiac arrest, and spent a week in intensive care.
On life support, breathing tube and all that kind of stuff, they told Lori my chances of coming out of it okay were 20%.
The medical ordeal was emotionally trying and potentially financially devastating. He was in the hospital for 40 days and rehab for 20. Kettlebaiter says his medical expenses were close to $1 million. Insurance, bought on the ACA marketplace, covered much of it.
We were able to get Obamacare, and at that point it was kind of like a matter of life and death.
Stories like Kettlebaiter's are part of the reason that getting rid of the Affordable Care Act is no easy task. Despite all its difficulties, for many people, the law is better than the health care system it replaced. The flip side is that health care premiums for most people have gone up under the ACA. Republicans have hammered this home, and over the past year, they've taken steps to address it. At the federal level, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to expand so-called association and short-term health plans.
In so many ways, change aimed at creating more and lower prices for millions of Americans.
But Trump's short-term plans don't cover much because they don't have to. They're not even considered insurance under the ACA. They were meant to be temporary, used by people in between jobs. If Obamacare goes away, Republicans say they'd bring back a health care option known as high-risk pools. These were often the only option for people with expensive medical problems before the ACA. Republican U.S. Senate candidate Leah Vukmir says they worked before and they could work again.
I support protecting people with pre-existing conditions. We did it here in Wisconsin before it was even part of Obamacare. I support bringing health care decision-making back to the states.
Wisconsin had a high-risk pool until 2014 that was touted as a national model. But it had high premiums and a lifetime limit on benefits. That worried cancer groups. Going back to that system could be especially difficult now, says Nancy Wenzel, the CEO of the Wisconsin Association of Health Plans. That's because more people have pre-existing conditions today compared to when Wisconsin's high-risk pool went away.
If we're talking about the population today, it's 10 times that amount. So we can't just plug and play a solution of the past.
The numbers bear that out. Wisconsin's high-risk pool covered 22,000 people at its peak. Today, 200,000 Wisconsin residents use the ACA's private marketplace. It means most of those people will be left with more questions than answers if the law goes away. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That was part two of a three-part series. Tune in tomorrow at this time during Central Time for the final installment of this series on healthcare issues in the midterm elections. Speaking of elections, Wisconsin Attorney General candidates incumbent Brad Schimmel and challenger Josh Call will debate for the first time this Friday night at 7:30. WPR will bring you that debate live, moderated by Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson. Ahead of that debate, join us for a special that looks at the Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senate that airs Friday at 7, followed by the debate at 7:30. Learn about all of our upcoming election specials and follow election news at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia are in the news this week with the disappearance of a journalist, the ongoing war in Yemen, and more. We'll get the latest and ask what you think. It's October, which means Halloween is on the way, and a Wisconsin expert looks back at burial customs in Wisconsin and around the nation, looking at the history of how we go into our final rest and some of the more unusual stories along the way. And on a yummier note, Food Friday this week is Fish Friday. An expert chef tells us how to cook with fish. You can join the show with your questions. Fish are kind of a final frontier for me. I'll cook a lot of things, but I'm always afraid I'll mess up that expensive fish, so I like to kind of steer clear. Hopefully I'll learn better. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.